The smile had returned to his face once more, and he replied, "Well now, that's what I call real kind. And, Missioner, not to interrupt you too long, dash, what about her? It mightn't do her any harm if she could come and have a look at them, dash, brighten her up a bit, so to speak. Well, your thought is a kindly one, but I fear she could not bear the journey yet a while. After a little, perhaps, but not just yet. But I may add this, I think I shall not have much difficulty, after all, in taking you where you will get a very good view of those brighter homes. Monday, February 10, 1919. 6:10 to 6:50 p.m. The man who had created this diversion was a horse breeder in a large way in the earth life, a man of great wealth. To see him now, his friends of those old days would have been somewhat surprised. He turned about and surveyed the audience with a smile and the attitude of a pleased schoolboy. Then he sat down well contented. He was of a nature unprogressed rather than malicious, a low type of the human species. There are many such. They do not descend to the lower hells on leaving the earth. They just go to their own place, which is where we have seen him, on the borderline between light and shadow. Here they are very unhappy for a time, but the same lack of spiritual conception which places them there, acts also as a counter-irritant. They soon begin to adjust themselves to their environment, and find more or less of ease because it is in sympathy with their own character. So long as there is no active hatred or other wickedness in their hearts, they make progress, slowly but steadily, and in that find satisfaction. They are incapable of any great good or any great evil. They are, of course, of higher intelligence and spiritual content than even the highest of the animals, but they are among the least developed of humankind. They may have been sharp-witted enough in earth life to have grown rich. That, however, avails them here very little, and I have known a definitely wicked man, once he has paid his debt in the darker hells, repented and turned toward the light, to make more rapid progress than such as these. An intelligent horse, with his many endearing qualities, has much in common with the nature of such as he of whom I have just spoken. Indeed, it was that fact that first turned him towards that animal in affection and, later, enabled him to convert his affection into much gold. The missionary resumed his address, his theme being the brighter conditions of life beyond the hills, towards which he endeavored to lure them. With this object in view, he exhibited to them the articles which entered into the life of that land. He showed them baskets of fruit which grew in the more advanced provinces of that region, books which were written by spirits in the spheres beyond, but made and bound there in the land of the dawning, pictures of scenery, and of ceremonies enacted there. All these he used as models in an object lesson very skillfully, answering their questions with patience and geniality. They thoroughly enjoyed it, and, when the time came to disperse, and then only, did he touch on a deeper theme. He asked them to kneel while he made a short simple prayer, and then dismissed them with his blessing. While they were dispersing, he conversed with the two women who had stood by the altar during the meeting. Presently one turned aside and left the chancel by a side door, returning shortly with Albert. To him the missioner said a few words, and he left the church by the great door through which the congregation had made their exit. In a few minutes he returned, with another man whom he led up the nave and placed before the missioner. This man was Paul, but greatly changed. His face was furrowed and full of sorrow, but there was no longer arrogance there, nor frenzy. These had given place to despair, and utter prostration of mind which, at this time of his return, was just giving place to humble, almost pathetic, dependence on the guiding of others. He had gone from one madness to another more mad, and had drunk to the dregs, the bitter cup of his defiance of the good. At last he had found that nothing there availed to satisfy his innermost nature, and he began to weary of the horrible life of the hells, and then to long for respite from the continual torture it inflicted. At last a glimmer of light entered into his soul. He seized and held on to the gleam, and, at the proper time, help came and he was guided by some invisible influence to the place where, at the head of the valley, Albert awaited him. He was lodged in the same hut to which he had been assigned on his first entrance into spirit life, and it was from that lodging he had now been brought. Tuesday, February 11th, 1919. 5:50 to 6:50 p.m. Paul knelt before the steps at the top, of which stood the missioner, and buried his face in his hands, with his forehead upon the ground. For a time they remained thus, Albert standing beside his charge. At last the old man spoke in a voice at once soothing and invigorating, "My son, you have paid some of your debt due to your own highest nature. I want you to know that. It is not to God to whom you have made recompense. We who come from the brighter spheres, know only a little of Him who in Himself encompasses infinitude. But we have learned so much as to know this at least, that it is not possible to make recompense to Him of whom is all that is, and we His children. That were presumption. As you go from one form to another higher in the school of instruction, you will come to understand that naught else would avail, other than that you have endured, if you would one day come to be truly yourself as you are potentially even now. Know this also, that you who have learned humbly through great pain and anguish of evil, are capable of endeavors as great in the service of the good. For to you have been given such talents as are not found in the characters of many who pass through this twilight land. It is therefore I may speak to you as I may not speak to those who have but lately listened to me here in this place so gladly. They are young children in capacity, and so must be dealt with in tenderness. You are of other sort, and I speak to you as man to man. Rise to your feet, my brother, for it is time for you to put out your strength for the work you have to do." For some short time Paul knelt in silence. Then slowly he arose and stood before the missioner, who continued, "So intense has been your suffering that, in your fight to become freedmen, you have not noted the changed aspect which has come upon you. When first you entered this life of spirit, you were small of stature. Compare now your height with that of Albert." Paul, who was standing side by side with his companion, turned and looked at his shoulder, for he was still ashamed to look upon his face. This doing, he found that himself was but a little shorter in stature, and that his limbs were almost as well developed. Then he raised his eyes to his face, greatly daring, and yet afraid. But when he saw that face brightened with a smile of glad joy and forgiveness, he could forbear no longer. Slowly he turned to him. Slowly he raised his hands and laid them one on each arm. Slowly he slid his hands up to his shoulders and, bending forward, laid his head, as a tired child would do, upon the bend of Albert's neck, and fell to weeping. Albert did not stir, but let him rest while the old man looked upon them in silence, into whose eyes there came a gleam of great love, as a mother looks upon her babe asleep, and stirs not lest she awakens him out of his dreaming. At last Paul drew apart and raised the left hand of the other to his lips, holding it there for a moment, then he quietly released it, turned to the missioner and awaited his further direction. No words were spoken between the two friends, both understood, and all was well. Then the old man spoke again, "And now, Paul, you shall go forth with your friend, who will instruct you where you next shall go, and also of your first duties. May our Father give you His strength, for it is His work you have to do." So they went down the nave and into the open, and here they turned to the right and walked along the path which led to the road. This was the highway of the valley. It passed through the distant group of huts where Paul's lodging had been, traversed the valley and, passing through the gate of the hills, emerged into the land of dawn beyond. Neither spoke as they went and, when they reached this highway, they paused, still full of thought, and silent. Paul waited for his friend to lead the way, but Albert stood there waiting also. At last, seeing the other in doubt which way to go, he said, "Well, Paul, my friend, which way left or right?" His companion looked to the left, which led to the settlement from which he had come, and to the right, where the brighter glow came from beyond through the gate, and touched the hilltops on either side of it. At last he turned to Albert and said, "Once I essayed this road before and lost myself in the awful darkness. It was in defiance of your advice I went that time. I failed to reach this far. I must have turned off somewhere soon after I left you, and strayed into the bylands. But this time you have brought me safely almost to the gate itself. We came at great speed also. And do you think you are able to continue onward through the gate and endure the greater light beyond? I will do my best if you will lead me, Albert, he replied. So they turned to the right, and along the broad highway. And as they went, the light became more mellow and, when they entered the pass between the hills, there were small shrubs and mosses and, here and there, a little rill beset with ferns. No stately trees were there, no beautiful flowers, but it seemed to Paul, after his long sojourn in those deep hells, as if the gate they were approaching must be that of paradise, and the road they trod the avenue of bliss. Chapter 5 The Land of the Dawning Thursday, February 13, 1919. 5.50 to 6.40 p.m. As they proceeded, the cliffs which bordered the highway on either hand took on a more verdant aspect. The vegetation which grew there became of a more luxuriant kind, and the light brightened with every step of the way. At last they came in view of the gate itself, through which they would pass into the brighter country beyond. It stood at the top of a rise in the road, and, as they went, they could see only the hills which lay at a great distance from the gate itself. Of the intervening land they could see nothing. While they were still some few miles away, Albert said to his companion, Paul, I have been to yonder gate once before and was enabled then to take a view of the country beyond. I was then still unfitted to travel further. They who keep the gate told me I should pass through when another should come with me. Meanwhile I was enjoined to be careful of my progress in order that, when the glad time came, I should be able to spare a little strength for my friend, who would not be quite so strong as I. Then we should be enabled to pass the gate together. Let us rest a while, and then we will continue our journey onward. So they found a moss-grown ledge of rock, and sat down side by side together. Paul was very happy in anticipation, but a little excited, and even disturbed, in mind, because of the uncertainty of his ability to adjust himself to the new conditions which awaited him beyond the brow of the hill, where stood the gate, 62 of the pass. So they sat in silence. And as they sat there Paul put out his hand and, taking that of his friend, laid it on his knee and held it there beneath his own. Albert felt the pressure, and it expressed a sense of growing humility and gratitude on the part of Paul. And as they so continued they grew together in affection. All enmity had departed and forgiveness on the part of the one responded gladly to the silent entreaty of the other. So absorbed were they that they did not notice the approach of a woman from the direction of the gate until she paused and stood before them. As they lifted their eyes, she said, "So I have found you as I had been hoping to find you, my two poor sufferers. But that is over now, and peace has followed hard upon the heels of reconciliation. You notice the results, do you not?" They looked at her in surprise, not understanding her. Then she laughed gladly and right heartily, as she stepped forward and, taking each by the arm, raised them to their feet and turned them about to confront each other. "There," she said. "Now what do you think?" They had both continued to gaze upon her in their surprise at her coming, and doubt as to her purpose. Still looking inquiringly into her face, Paul said, "Sister, I am thinking that, for a young woman, your grip is only equaled by the quality of your muscles." At this she laughed the more, and addressed the other, "Albert, my son, cannot you find something to say just a little more to the point than your friend's remark?" "Well," replied Albert, "he is certainly right, sister, and I can quite understand Paul's surprise. You see, he interprets your age and experience by your appearance, which is that of quite a young girl. He is not aware how long you have been here, nor the fact that your proper home is some spheres beyond. That is why he is surprised at your strength." "P64, my good friends," she answered, "what dullards you both are. Look at each other, and not at me, and tell me what comma. Oh, at last you catch my meaning." "Well, sister," answered Albert, "I can scarcely put it into words. But certainly Paul's dress has changed since we came from the church yonder." "Yes," she replied, "I was much amused that neither of you had noticed it. Let me explain to you. You did not imagine you could enter into respectable society in the rags you wore over there, did you? I want you to realize that beyond the gate the people are quite different from those among whom you have lived hitherto. The dress you at present wear consorts with theirs, and you will be able to mix with them now on equal terms. What made them change like this? Inquired the still perplexed Paul. They have been changing ever since you made your decision when, on coming to the highway, you took your courage into your hands and turned hitherward. As you go forward on your way from strength to strength, you will learn that the clothes you wear express the correspondence you are able to make to your environment. That is the scientific way to speak of it. In other terms, I would express it thus: your robe is made of the vital exhalations of your individuality and embroidered with your aspirations after further holiness. The present result is the effect of the climax you have attained as you came on this last journey of yours, the crown of your repentance and endeavors after the good. But now we must be going, for friends await you a little way ahead, and will be hardly patient of our delay if we tarry further. Let us go forward together. Friday, February 14th, 1919. 5.55 to 7.0 p.m. The gate stood on the brow of the hill up which the road mounted from those darker regions which lay away to the west. As the roadway rose towards this gap, the cliffs fell away until, when the gate itself was reached, there was but a wall of rock on the north side of the highway some 5 or 6 feet in height. On the south side stood a bluff, about 100 feet high. But when the gate was passed, this ceased, for the road here gave on to an open stretch of parkland which dipped down to a valley. Through this valley a broad river ran from the north and wound round into the hill country, disappearing among the woods which grew right up to the rocky boundary as it stretched away on either side of the gate. The gate itself was simply the gap formed by the rocky walls of the highway, but it was flanked on either hand by a high tower where watch was constantly maintained. The object of these watchtowers was twofold: that on the south stood on the summit of the bluff, and was in touch with the far-stretching region of the Land of the Dawning, and also with that smaller hilly shire which lay between it and the church to the west and south. The other kept watch over the highway, and also those dark regions which stretched away to the north and west, where Paul had wandered for so long a season. This is by far the larger of the two structures, and the work which is done there is very strenuous, and not a little difficult. Of all the millions who inhabit those drear lands below, the history and present location of each is registered. So it is known what help is needed in any district, and also the most competent way in which such help can be given. It was from this tower that Sister was summoned when she was sent, at one time to the help of Monica, and at another time to the chateau. Do you mean that the tower is in touch with all the hells, however deep? No, no. There are other stations in the further regions of anguish, and those are in contact, not with either of these towers, but with councils of very powerful officers in the higher spheres. The work here is just local, and concern only with the region of which we have written. It is a very extensive one, nevertheless, and has a large, if mosfly scattered, population. Any towns? No, those are further away, and in a still darker sphere. In this land of gloom there are communities, some numbering a few hundreds, others a dozen or so. But there are no large towns. Why? Because here the people are varied in character in a greater degree than is the case with those who gravitate lower and further away. This is, as you would probably describe it, one of the upper hells. It is where those go who are bad, but who have in them such redeeming features as will enable them to turn towards the light without the necessity of still more deeply descending into the darkness. The more pronouncedly evil go further away and, because there is not so much mixture of good with the evil in them, they are able to band together to pool their wickedness. Perhaps you will understand what I mean. But here the blends of good and evil in the individual soul vary so much in the nature and proportion of the ingredients that they find little material of so substantial a nature as to make cooperation possible. So, instead of eternities, these people spend but a few years in this region. That suffices for what amount of frenzy there is in them to make its folly manifest. They tire of it all, become utterly weary, and begin to long for better things. Paul and Albert are good examples of the class of whom I speak. How long do the people remain there? I speak, of course, according to your earth time, as I have spoken of the locality in terms of the compass. Their probation usually lasts from 1 to 7 or 8 years. Some have been there 100 years, or even longer. But such cases are rare in this particular country. In the lower hells there are those who have been there for thousands of years. When eventually they are rescued, they do not pass through this district. They go by another way. But we have spoken enough of the darkness. Let us turn now to the dawning. Paul was lost in admiration of the scene before him. There were islands dotted about the river's course on which were kiosks and summer houses, and on one larger island a music pavilion. Here was an orchestra which made music that floated over the lawns and flower gardens and houses, and bathed all in a flood of melody. It brought a sense of restful content to the two weary newcomers who stood there wrapped in ecstasy. So great was the contrast, and so sudden had it been sprung upon Paul, that he forgot his companions and stood wrapped in silent wonderment. At last his lips moved, as to him CJF he murmured, "Yes, God lives." It was the first time that name had been on his lips since he had left the earth life. He paused for a few moments, still in a deep rapture of solemn meditation, then added, "And loves." Then he remembered he was not alone, and, as he turned to Sister, she noticed there were tears in his eyes. "Paul," she said, "you are thinking this is heaven. My poor tired friend, to you it must seem so. But, believe me, this is not even paradise. It is but the land of the dawning. The light to you here is mellow, and the air is full of peace. But over yonder hills there are beauties far greater than any you see here. This is but a resting place for pilgrims such as you. It is not your home. Do you live here, sister?" "No, no one lives here permanently. They rest, and pass on to brighter places beyond the hills, or wait here for some friend with whom they may journey onward in company. Now let us go down towards the gardens, and I will introduce you to some of those we shall find there." They descended and, at the foot of the rise, they found a large stretch of parkland and gardens intermingled. There were lawns, groves, arbors, beds of flowers, and wild flowers growing among the trees and in the wooded vales, rills of water also where ferns grew and, here and there, a dwelling house. They turned down a bypath, in the wood, which was flanked with thickly growing bushes on either hand. Suddenly they found themselves opposite an open pavilion, which stood back a little from the road, with a path, a few yards in length, leading up to its open entrance. Here Sister paused and bade the two men wait while she went within. When she returned, she led by the hand two women, who came forward with radiant faces, and took each her husband within her arms. "And now," said Sister, "go forward together. The light brightens over the horizon yonder. Peace lies beyond the hills, and there I will meet with you once again." The end. From all blindness of heart, from pride, vainglory and hypocrisy, from envy, hatred and malice, and all uncharitableness, good Lord, deliver us. Anglican Litany. 1.